Well,
technology.
so I wouldn't shut up during Liam's nice review, and so Joe suggested that we have a discussion. This is just a discussion. But let me just start. There's a huge opportunity that has developed over the past few years. So as Liam explained, inflation is sensitive to UV physics. It's sensitive to Planck suppressed operators. In a way that actually overlaps with upcoming data. So there's a real genuine intersection here, which is particularly pronounced in the case of large field inflation, which is probably the jumping off point for the discussion. So just as a, what's the word? Just to get us started, let's look at where the theory is and the data will be on this kind of question. So what's plotted here is the tilt of the spectrum, the power spectrum in inflation on the horizontal axis, and the tensor to scalar ratio that describes the strength of the gravitational wave signature from inflation. So this vertical axis is particularly interesting because it's tied directly to the scale of inflation. It's sort of opposite from collider physics. In this case, you get to see gravity waves if the scale is high enough, as opposed to in particle physics, where you get to see things if the scale is low enough. And it's also tied to the range that the inflaton field varies over during inflation. So I would be happy to explain that. It's like a two-line derivation if people want to see that. But for those two reasons, this quantity in particular is sensitive to UV physics. And so this plot on the left shows the current constraints. So WMAP 1 and 2 sigma contours are these funny blobs here. There's a degeneracy between gravity waves and then the tilt of the spectrum because gravity waves start to dilute like a damped oscillator inside the horizon. And so that's why you have contours shaped like this. And then theoretical possibilities for inflation are sort of organized here on this plot where sort of the naively simplest m squared phi squared type model sits here, kind of on the way out, perhaps. Then things like field theoretic axion inflation, which was sort of optimistically named natural inflation, lies along this line, and more general power law inflation with different powers are plotted here. The lower the power that you have, the farther in you get. And then there's a possibility of just small energy, small field inflation, which is not too visible for these observables, but then there are other opportunities, perhaps cosmic strings and so on, that you could look for in those examples. So that's the, and then this is categorizing whether it's large field or small field, whether the curvature of the potential is positive or negative, and so on. Okay, so the data eventually, because of upcoming satellite experiments and ground and balloon-based experiments, is expected to give an ultimate exclusion plot of a contour of about this size on such a plot. We can see that that's going to be good enough, for example, to distinguish these different powers, to distinguish large from small field inflation, and to be better on the tilt of the spectrum. And then, aside from these observables, there's a whole there's really a function's worth of information in the power spectrum, and there are nonlinear corrections and non-Gaussian corrections.
One question, you label these things by potentials, but as you mentioned, some of the theories kind of have non-Gaussianity also, and it's not obvious in those theories the potential is the right way to label the curve.
Oh, absolutely.
So are there presumably hosts of other candidates that just aren't on this plot?
Oh, absolutely, yeah, that's important. So, one thing that one might discuss is how to formulate this more systematically. So in field theory, this is starting to be done, for example, for single field inflationary models where Hubble and its time derivatives are slow, you get a very systematic treatment of all these examples based on an interesting effective field theory treatment. So it'd be nice to have some, because the subject is UV sensitive, it'd be nice to somehow generalize that to the full top-down situation. So that's where it's going, and Planck is going to launch on May 6th now is the current estimate. So we have 3 years from then to get our act together and be ready. So we could discuss any aspects of this that you want. I have some ideas for what we might discuss. But just start talking whenever you want.
Even the small ellipse that you had on your second thing, that's just Planck, or that's where we're going?
Oh, I'm sorry. Do you want to see it again? Or?
No,
okay, that Planck was intermediate. So Planck is going to do sort of okay on gravity waves, get the tilt a little bit better, and just cover the non-Gaussianity.
Can I get a clarification on that, though? That was a log scale, and there was a nice contour in the middle. I mean, certainly they can't be arbitrarily sensitive on that one. Like, I can't put that contour anywhere.
A very, very good point. So, indeed, in the that was centered around, that little ellipse was centered around R of 0.01. Okay. This is about the what. So maybe it would be worth, because not everybody studied the subject. Let me explain the UV sensitivity point about the tensor to scalar ratio and so on. Would this be helpful for people? It's like a three line thing, and it's related to your question. So, you want me to turn this on?
Yeah.
I think. Let's see. Is this the right thing? Oh. Yes. Yeah, this is it. This is it. That's like somebody's TV. Okay. So let me just explain this large field business and tensor modes, just because it is an important case and very simple. So the number of E-foldings in inflation, right, is given by integrating dA over A throughout the process. So let's write this as dA dt over A dt. Let's write this as d phi over phi dot, right? So this is Hubble over phi dot d phi. And let's also take into account that the power in tensor modes just scales like Hubble. That's hopefully intuitive. It just scales like the energy density in inflation. These are gravity waves. And the scalar power, again, this is a slight specialization to the slow roll models, but whatever. It scales like h to the fourth over phi dot squared. So that means, given that Hubble and phi dot change slowly during inflation, you can basically pull them out of this integral, and you're getting that. This goes like the range of the field during inflation. I need one more thing. So this quantity R that I was plotting is the ratio of these two things. So that's h squared over, phi dot squared over h squared m Planck squared, right?
It's pH over PS.
What I meant. So now, did I do this right? Yes. So from this, so what we're getting is that the number of E-foldings then goes like delta phi over m Planck r to the 1/2, or writing it out, delta phi over m Planck goes like the number of E-foldings times r to the 1/2. And, you know, roughly speaking, this number of E-foldings is of order 10. So this is like R over 0.01 to the 1/2. Okay. So this value of 0.01 is on the boundary between super and sub-Planckian ranges of the field during inflation. And it's happens to be the place down to which the experimentalists think they can get. observationally within, you know, the foreseeable near-term future. And so that's just a good thing. I mean, this is one number, but it's as significant as a single number can basically be. It's related to interesting theoretical issues because the larger this is, if this is bigger than one, then the field is traversing this long distance in field space. This does not mean anything about going to high energies. That is, the field strength being bigger than M Planck, of course, is not out of control from the effective field theory point of view. But it does mean that one needs to have control over the effective action for the scalar field over a long distance. And the simplest way, I think the only known way to do that, is using symmetries, so delta phi for M Planck can be controlled by symmetries in a very simple way. And this was realized early on in effective field theory. For example, you can think about, say, just M squared phi squared and just declare that your classical Lagrangian has no other terms that break this symmetry except weak couplings to the standard model. Or perhaps more appealingly, you can think about axions, which have a natural underlying shift symmetry. So there you get a potential that scales something like this in terms of the axion decay constant. And in this case, what you needed to get, you know, the right to match the basic phenomenology is a periodicity of the axion that's a bit bigger than the Planck scale. So in field theory, this is fine. You can just specify this as the shift symmetry, this is its period, and get a prediction for so-called natural inflation. But it raises the question of whether this really occurs in some UV-complete setup, right? And so this question has been asked in string theory. And the first thing that was noticed by Banks and Dine, Gukov, and
Fox and Gorbatov,
right, is that, well, in regimes of control in string theory, we have lots and lots of axions, right? Half the scalar fields are basically angular variables like this. But in string theory, under control, we find that, in fact, these scales are separated by some inverse powers of the size of the cycles that the axions thread. So the simplest thing that you might think about in field theory does not turn out to be available, or the simplest thing that you would think about in string theory. Sure.
You said this, by a shift symmetry, you mean there are discrete symmetry in shifts phi by integer multiples of f?
Yeah. So let me explain it a little more slowly. So, axions they're derivatively coupled and they have a shift symmetry classically,
right.
But then instantons can violate that shift symmetry. So, the idea here was that these roughly speaking, these are exponentially suppressed by some instanton action. So you get a naturally low scale of the residual potential.
I see.
Was the word natural also supposed to imply that there's no inner problem here?
Yeah, actually.
Presumably, once you turn on the instantons, the inner problem comes in too, or is it?
Well, with large field models, the eta problem is gone once you have the symmetry, just in that you could even ask this with M squared phi squared, where there's a symmetry. So basically, you know, V double prime, V prime, V double prime, et cetera, go like powers of M Planck over phi. So if you can get out to large fields using a symmetry to control it.
So just make the axiom discussion. So you're saying that if you do this instant calculation, you get a potential that looks something like that. Terms that are, you know, higher Fourier modes, closer to 2 phi over f, are suppressed by some additional power of e to the minus 1 over g or something?
Yeah, so, right, so this scheme works best in a situation where instantons really give a good controlled expansion, where the two instanton effect is smaller than the first one instanton effect and so on. So what's kind of optimistically been happening lately in this subject is that the things that look simplest from field theory, which have definite predictions that I showed on those plots a few minutes ago, don't immediately drop out of string theory, but instead some variant of them does drop out of string theory with different predictions that are testable. So let's start with the axion case. So there are two ways in which axions and their shift symmetry do embed into string theory in a way that does give inflation despite this fact that the decay constant is sub-Planckian, which involves either considering the fact that you have lots of axions in general in complicated string compactification, and if you use this kind of potential in many different directions at once, you get a kind of assisted inflation effect. Or even at the level of a single axion, it's actually not true that axions in string theory are periodic. In the presence of wrapped brains and general fluxes, axions actually are not quite periodic. There's monodromy. The energy increases as you move around these circles quite generically. So here you get, you know, essentially a spiral staircase sort of potential, which you can compute. And it unpacks to something that has at large radius one of these interesting powers, like 1 or 2/3 in the cases that have been looked at for axions. P equals 1 is. Yeah, so then you get a washboard on top of it with more model dependent effects, but the basic RNS plot that I showed would make, you know, predictions from this, and also from inflation because of initial conditions, you get predictions that are distinct from either m squared, phi squared, or just pure natural inflation. So one question is whether this is significant. You know, is this just an accident of what we happen to land on first, or can we be more systematic about this and, you know. But sorry.
And before we go on, could I just make a comment about Albion's point? I think in general there is a washboard, and I think this is related to Joe's question, namely, one wants to know whether the modulations that arise on top of this coming from instanton effects are in general more important, or parametrically less important than the linear potential that he was drawing, which is coming from wrapped brain effects. And one can construct situations where it's true that the linear potential is more important, but I think one open question is that actually generic?
Are there any limitations on periodic features of this kind from the data?
Yeah,
well,
there are.
Why don't you get up and tell us about it? This is a discussion.
You want me to actually get up there, Thomas? I'm happy to if you want to.
Well, you would.
Yeah, okay.
So once you lift this periodicity, haven't you also broken the shift symmetry classically?
Classically? Only through instantons. I mean,
you've broken it
through
slow.
Sorry. Oh, yeah. So the leading thing that in these kinds of situations, if the leading thing that breaks the symmetry is the implanton potential itself, it's self-consistent, so you can calculate loops.
Right. So in the field theory case, you want the instantons to be the only thing that breaks the leading thing which breaks the shift symmetry. But now, here when you put on these wrapped brains, you've broken the shift symmetry by something else, right?
Sorry, actually, but an analogy, I would say what you would want it to do in the field theory case, you have two possibilities. One of them is having these periodic effects be the only thing breaking the shift symmetry. Another argument you could have made is just suppose the polynomial term is the only thing breaking the shift symmetry. That's what is going to happen here. The polynomial term will be a linear term that's coming from a wrapped brain, and that's the leading thing breaking.
Right, and as long as that's true, it actually turns out to be self-consistent.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's enough to protect,
So suppose you do then have some sort of situation where you have, let's consider a wrapped five-brain on some curve, sigma 2, and so I have some curve like this. Let me put it in a warped region so I can suppress the tension of the wrapped brain, because otherwise it would be some m string to the fourth over g string squared. And you can find what the potential is. Well, the potential is going to be asymptotically linear, as you pointed out over there, and the reason for that is that there's an action for this guy, which is of the form square root of the determinant g plus b, integrated over that two cycle. And since it's a two cycle and you evaluate it, really you find it goes linearly in B. I want to consider the estimable configuration for an NS5 ring. So that's where this linear structure comes. It goes like 5. And let me put a dimensionful parameter mu cubed there, which represents, well, the tension of the 5 ring here and any warping effect, et cetera. And then one wants to know what's the additional thing that happens. Well, I just would add to that the non-perturbative corrections. Okay, and let me just write it as a cosine now. So this is indeed a washboard, something like this. And then at the origin, it smooths out, because at the origin, B is not large compared to G, and you evaluate the square root slightly differently, and it becomes smoother, and let me make it asymptote to zero. Also. So then one would ask, what are the signatures of this? What are the constraints on this? It can do two things for you. So as you're sliding down this thing, the interval time is slowing down and speeding up. So you can imagine, given this h to the fourth over phi dot squared, that there will be periodic modulations in the two-point function. So you could just compute the primordial two-point function as a function of k. Actually, let me write it as a function of log k over some scale k star. And you'll get something that will look like this. Namely, the power spectrum is some usual power spectrum k over k star to the ns minus 1 times some amplitude, plus an additional correction. And the correction is some, let me write it, alpha log k, alpha cosine of log k over f.
So this is, it may be good to stop here and just point out that when we plot the data from the CNB, it's often just boiled down to a few numbers like r and an s. So with what we talked about originally, we just talked about r and an s. But it really is a function. So one just sort of general question is, how much of the functionness of it are we going to be interested in? And you know what I mean?
If there were general features all over the place, you would expect you would eventually be able to get to see all of them, and down to some amplitude.
Right.
And out to some maximum L, maybe 2,000 or something like this.
Yeah.
So in this case, the constraints are a little bit weak.
And F is measured in Planck units?
Yeah, right. This F is the same as that F, which is indeed measured in Planck units, and it'll be smaller than M-Planck.
Since the number of each voltage you have to go to see a perturbation is just going down there.
Yes, so the number of them that you'll see on the sky is going to be, well, in any case where these models will work, the number on the sky will be more than one. In general, I would say it's something like 10 or perhaps larger.
It's larger because...
Because F has to be small. F has to be small for the control of the string theory construction
generally. F is small, means the thing wiggles fast.
Right. Yes, that's right. And you have to go over many bumps in order to build up for yourself a large order 10 M Planck range to inflate. You move over one Planck unit during the 60 E-fold, during the 10 observable E-folds, you move over about delta 5, 1 M Planck.
Good, that's the number.
That's the number, but that's more than F. That's several more than F, so you see a bunch of these bumps.
So it's clear that if it got too wiggly, it would just wash out, right? The bins are too dilute in the current data. So it could be there at a very, very rapid rate with essentially no constraint, right?
Absolutely. For sufficiently sufficiently small f, sufficiently large frequency, there will be many of these per CL bin.
You either had a more general power, I'm not sure about linear, but with general power, the thing is, of course, interacting. And reheating, of course, means it's interacting anyway. So there would be mu to some power, phi over M Planck type corrections to your potential also on top of the instantons. For reasonable parameters, are those negligible compared to your lambda to the fourth correction?
Well, those corrections there are corrections which come from, also corrections break the shifting curve.
Of course.
So the response, the same way. The proportional to higher powers of mu.
Exactly.
Yes.
But
so they're negligible by the, I would say, the same argument that works for this case. Namely, if the small parameter here is m, and if you run this and loops it, et cetera.
Well, this case is actually free. And with lambda 5 to the fourth, there's some subtle, it's not exactly immediately clear that if lambda wasn't so tiny, that would be stable against even what you have to make reheating work. So my question is basically, is it true with real numbers that.
Right. So I think what will happen is we'll have higher powers of u cubed 5. Over your cutoff scale, which will then be smaller, because U cubed is...
Oh, your cutoff scale here is much higher than M Planck, because you've controlled the potential output.
I wouldn't say it's much smaller. No, I'd say it's M Planck.
Well, phi over M Planck is actually a large parameter, so if you get higher powers, then that
would... No, what you'll get is something like mu cubed phi, squared over lambda to the fourth. Sorry, this is some new lambda. I'll just call it capital M. Capital M is maybe of order M Planck, not larger. And my claim is just that the smallness of mu... I mean, this is something big, 10. now you've got 100, but then there's mu to the 6.
Also, these things you're talking about are likely to themselves be periodic. I mean, so I don't think it's... You don't expand in phi. It's just some periodic function in phi.
Well, sorry, why is it periodic once you added the leading piece that was interacting? It wouldn't be periodic, right? Radiative corrections due to the linear term. I mean, with linear and quadratic.
Mu cube phi doesn't generate any radiative corrections by itself.
Well, that's why.
Right?
For phi itself, but for p greater than 2 or something, or even p between 1 and 2, the theory is interacting.
Well, okay, so we checked this for 2/3 and it's safe. I mean, you generate inverse powers in phi. But
yeah, I don't know any example that's interactive.
But I think what Albion was asking was just what is the status of the constraints and the forecast for...
So what we're left with here in this class of models, so I'll say slightly more generally about the constraints slightly outside this class of models, but this is actually a very good representation. I mean, one can just analytically compute the two-point function in this case, and you find this. Okay, where alpha is something that we can compute. And f, this frequency, is the same as the frequency in this function. This is the primordial power spectrum. You want to know what the CLs are. But it's going to map in some very nice way onto the CL. So you know, I could draw the curve of the acoustic peaks, and there'll be some ripples on top of that. As you can imagine, if the frequency of those ripples coincides with the frequency in the acoustic peaks, then there's some degeneracy with cosmological parameters. If it doesn't coincide with them, then you have a slightly harder task. But this has been looked for. In particular, it was looked for by people who were interested in alpha vacuum. They studied almost exactly the same parameterization. It turns out they have one more parameter to tune than we have here. But this can mock up the alpha vacua ripples. Okay. And what was done there, the constraints, I think if I'm writing this correctly, I don't want to quote a number for you now because I don't know the number properly in terms of this quantity alpha. Okay. The best thing to say is that deviations, so it's the thing about the following. This h to the fourth over phi dot squared roughly tells you about the variations in speed. And so you can associate this to some delta eta, some periodic contributions to eta and epsilon, and sort of naively carry those through and compute the corrections of the two-point function. And the way you're thinking about the constraints now is that this is less than or equal to of order 10 to the minus 2. Now, we can be precise, perhaps afterward I could. You know, we can put this in here. Yeah, it mm-hmm. can be. So let me see. I'm afraid of losing a factor of f here. That's why. I think it's roughly something like 10 to the minus 4, or something like this.
Wait, you're just over.
This is what I'm trying to put in the constraint.
Over mu cubed f, right?
Well, what I know is the constraint on lambda to the fourth over mu cubed f. Yeah, lambda to the fourth over mu cubed, indeed. Perfect. That's the right constraint. Lambda to the fourth over mu cubed less than
mu cubed f.
So that's
but this is at a particular value of f, right? Because again, the constraint goes completely away.
So indeed, for small enough f, this fails. For small enough f, the oscillations are so fast you couldn't see them at all. But in an intermediate range of f, where you're ranging between about 1 and about 1,000, a few hundred oscillations on this guy, it's roughly true that this quantity is constrained with almost the same constant. Okay, it's of order 10 to the minus 4. So some of this work was done by Mahmoud, Kaminkowski, and Little, and then we have some ongoing work. That's constraining this a little bit.
Do you get spikes in power as you crank lambda up? You would be slowing down on top of the little hills that are appearing on your potential?
Yeah, that's some sort of degenerate limit which we haven't taken, but you would imagine that's what
if you got spikes in power, that's probably constrained separately. But.
Yeah, that's correct. So all I've done here is talk about a strictly monotonic case where this washboard is a little bit inaccurate. I want to be smoothly rolling over each of these things, not slowing down for an arbitrarily long time in each of these pockets. So the next exciting thing actually about this is, so this is constrained. And what's sort of amusing is the general size of these corrections, you know, it's computable. You propose a model where you know what the modular barriers are, and you know the instanton actions that are spoiling the shift. And so depending on some microvisible functions, one can compute what this lambda is. And one typically finds that in some reasonable range of configurations, you would expect to have seen these things or to see them. They're exponentially small, but they're exponentially small in some quantity that can't be too big. The reason it can't be too big is you have to have gut scale barriers, gut scale energy densities for this model anyway. So it's exponentials of a few. And so one actually expects to see these things in some fraction of models. We wouldn't even pretend to count and say, you know, in some, I'm not going to try to remember what that
is. And the same is true of the non-Gaussian correction.
Right, so the exciting thing, I think more exciting than this, I mean, this is nice, you can see some function here. But there's a proposal by Chen, Easter, and Lim, which says that although non-Gaussianity can't be produced effectively in most single field models with canonical kinetic terms, which this has a canonical kinetic term, I didn't write that for you, but the kinetic term, you know, I could just have written it as d phi squared, which is just f squared d c squared if c is the Ramon 2-4 maximum. This is a model with a canonical kinetic term, but something funny is happening. It's interacting in a strange way. And the proposal of Chen, Easter, Lim is that this can give rise to a so-called resonant non-Gaussianity, meaning that well inside the horizon, the modes are oscillating anyway. But this is a driving force. And there comes a frequency, so this driving force changes frequency effectively, and there comes a frequency when those things resonate. When those things resonate, you produce a large three-point function. And that large three-point function can be computed in terms of these parameters, and one finds there's some, what do you call it, FNL resonant.
Something over F, right? This is why I asked you to understand that.
It goes like something like lambda to the fourth over F to the 5/2. I'm not sure I got that exactly right, but that certainly has the right spirit in it.
And what kind of triangles does that peak on?
Yeah, so we don't really know.
It has a right to peak on squeezed triangles, possibly, even though it's single field. So there's this whole, it's because the derivatives of Hubble can get large in this example, because you pull out 1 over F factors.
What's known is the shape along the equilateral profile. What's not known is the support on other shapes, at least not known to me. We're trying to look into that. So roughly, a better way of writing this is looking at this as actually omega over H, some power that I think is 3/2, where omega is the frequency with which this thing is actually oscillating inside the horizon. Because this is some solution which you can think of as a background motion and a bouncing motion. The bouncing motion has some physical frequency omega. When that frequency is larger than Hubble, it bounces a few times, and the non-Gaussianity is proportional to that
frequency.
Well, you could think of this production as being coming from a kind of resonance. We actually attempted to do that, and I would not say we're totally successful, but I think it's, okay, good. I can say something about that, which is, when you actually compute this two-point function,
yes.
What you're doing is you're solving the Mukano-Sasaki equation with some background. But of course, you do some integral by stationary phase to end up computing it. And the stationary phase contribution should be then thought of, I would say, as a resonant contribution. The stationary phase measures an effective temporary cancellation between the background natural frequency and the driving frequency.
Yes.
And that, I would say, is nothing but a resonant production. So it's in that sense that the two-point function is also resonant.
So when some frequencies happen to coincide, for some special cases, you get something that doesn't.
I wouldn't say in special cases. See, the physical driving frequency is effectively changing monotonically, and so different modes are exiting at different times, but each mode becomes resonant at some time.
Oh, I see.
And so this will be effectively scale invariant modulated by a cosine, and each of the modes that becomes resonant at some time, it's then that it produces this corresponding ripple.
So
that shape comes from resonance. No, I would say the cosine itself is coming from the resonance. Each mode resonates at a given time.
Okay. I guess the question is, could it be driven non-linear? I guess that would involve something like what Sean was asking. With
We only know things, I personally only know things about this in the linear regime.
Okay.
So can I ask, this mu is small, but because of the warping, and can I just dial this down into some kind of small field inflation regime by just making mu smaller?
No. The reason is that your slow roll parameters, expressions all over here, the slow roll parameters will go like, eta is 0, but epsilon will go like m5 over 5 squared.
one thing you can do. You can go to a small field regime working here if you take into account that you might have particle production events that happen as you keep going around the circle, depending on how things are arranged, and that can slow you down and give you inflation too, but that's a different mechanism. So yesterday Ben was trying to get us to a prediction of, for example, whether we'd have large field or small field inflation. That seems to me pretty ambitious, so we could discuss, intuitions behind, say, initial conditions for one or the other. At the level that we're working here, we see very clearly that we can do science with inflation and string theory because of this overlap, but it's really a matter of, distinguishing different mechanisms using the data. It's not something where there's some overarching prediction from string theory. There seem to be valid models that are either predict tensor modes or don't. The mechanisms behind them are very, very different. So we'll learn a lot from this, but it would be interesting if one could, get a better idea of what to expect even beyond this kind of model building. So to make the discussion interesting, we could try and have some sort of discussion or debate about that. But let me just start by giving the, so people and I hope they will object to this, but I'm going to start by giving the arguments for large field, which by the way, I had before I ever worked on the subject. Yeah.
Before you started this, so you've been focusing on a couple of observables, including a couple of results, it would be a third one, on the power spectrum and the range of the gravitational waves.
Yeah.
Now, in principle, everything that has been said, I guess that from the perspective of other observables, you are basically, the ones that have already been measured, you are basically working around some average value that has already been established.
Yeah, so these
but let me come to the issue of, for instance, another possible observable which has not been measured, which just means that there is a bound, so just as R has not been measured and there is an upper bound.
Mm-hmm.
So for instance, these are curvature perturbations which are naturally arising in
more
than one scalar field rolling.
Right.
Is this I mean, it seems like a natural.
Oh, there, yeah, absolutely.
To include in the discussion, but then.
Yeah.
It becomes a little bit more murky.
Oh, it's great. No, every number you can add is worthwhile.
What I mean is that the slow roll analysis then depends a little bit more on the details of the model and things like that. I mean, I don't know how much this has been analyzed or things like that.
Well, okay, so people are trying to generalize this effective field theory of inflation just in field theory that I described to multiple field model. It's tricky, though, because you have to include not just effects like what you're talking about, but the possibility that particles are produced among the extra fields. One interesting thing is that these models with non-trivial kinetic terms and low sound speed lead to effective mass. So fields can contribute if their mass, so in normal inflation, fields can contribute if their mass is less than Hubble. So these extra fields that you're talking about only really matter if, for some reason that you would like to explain, there are extra light fields, extra fields that are lighter than Hubble beyond the one inflaton that you need. But in these models of more generic, more general models with low sound speed, instead you get some statement like this. And so, indeed, the kind of classification that you do depends on things like the structure of the kinetic terms and how many fields you have. And so there is room for a much more systematic treatment. I'm not sure I would like to get all programmatic about it, because a lot of the discoveries here were, I know, rather more serendipitous than coming from some, let's follow some program. But I think there's room for we've learned a lot, and I think there's room for some kind of classification. Okay. But I was going to try and start a fight, so let's let's talk about whether, in sort of the same spirit that Ben did yesterday, but maybe a little less in a less sophisticated way, let's ask about large field versus small field inflation. So, from a model building point of view, they're both fine. Large field has a symmetry protecting it. small field. Does not need to control a potential over a very long distance, and so it's basically a 1% fine tune, which has been really beautifully characterized in some of these brain models that Liam talked about, say as an example in string theory. So this is just from the model building point of view what you need to do. And then from the point of view of initial conditions, well, large field, if we just went over, corresponds to high scale, and you get to see tensor modes. And what that means also is that the initial Hubble patch is that much smaller than it is for small field inflation, lower scale inflation. So in order to get started with inflation, you need to have a Hubble patch that is smooth enough. So here, you just need smoothness over some, smaller patch than you do for small field inflation.
Doesn't bubble inflation help
with it?
Bubble inflation sort of created by a smooth patch on hyperwood.
Could be. Okay.
Another thing, what you mean by initial here?
Well, that's the same thing.
So if you stick a thing in internal bubble inflation, internal inflation.
Yeah,
I mean, that's sort of neutral between these two, is what you're saying.
I guess that's right.
But here, when you say initial, okay. You know, the 60th e-folding, and mm-hmm. It's easy to imagine that there was a lot of e-folding before what we see.
It's easier to imagine that in this case than it is in this case.
Right. So in particular, we would guess that you started inflating at the Planck scale or whatever.
Yeah.
And you're seeing some last vestige of that. And in a large field, you basically have to inflate at the Planck scale anyways.
No.
It's
a gut scale. So answers to this might include bubbles just what were you saying?
I recall starter inflation. There's no reason that what we see at the 60th e-folding is even a continuous process starting at the start of inflation. This is related to bubbles, but it could even be.
But then you're swapping the initial condition fine tune for the fine tune that inflation belongs all the way up to
right.
The scale down the low scale.
Well, here you get it from a symmetry. Yes, that's good. Everyone's a winner. So that could well be how it is. Okay, so that those are good answers. So high, low. The other thing to say, perhaps. And you can also argue about this. There's further model building you can do. But in small field inflation, it's, there's a small range of field where you arrange this 1% fine-tuned so as to inflate. So you get a picture sort of like this. And the obvious question is, what about overshooting it? How do you get yourself to naturally be there? Whereas perhaps in these other examples, you just sort of have to start somewhere near the top of the potential.
But the bubble inflation does help with this overshoot issue.
It helps,
because
but it's
you have this friction.
It helps with a range of field, as I understand it, that's about as big as the range that you need. So at least in some simple examples, right? So what Ben is saying, I think, is that if you nucleate a bubble, you have curvature domination at first, which introduces friction and slows you down. But it doesn't slow you down if you start too far from the point. There are also ideas for using particle protection or other effects to slow you down and land you here,
Let me ask you a question.
The current best guess for a brain inflation model is that we're on a little step like that? Is there a simple reason why?
Well, it's just that you're tuning different things. What else?
It's just easier to tune that.
Why do you say that's the best? I mean, that's if there's a dimension of, if there's an operator of dimension 3/2 in the throw.
So this is specific.
If there was an operator of dimension 2, then the guess would be to tune mass.
That's good. So it was specific.
So it was specific to where A and B have dimension 3/4.
So what do you?
Well, anything less than 2. Yeah. I mean, if you have a throw that has some chiral operator with dimension less than 2, and that you have included namely you haven't imposed a global symmetry in the whole Holcomb application that forbids it, then you would expect some inflection point.
Like Bing, otherwise on the part of the two delta.
Well, so what? How would you draw it in this other case? I'm not. You would draw it as attuned mass. What does that mean?
So you draw a Coulomb potential.
Plus attuned mass.
Attune the mass to be negligibly small and just draw a Coulomb potential.
Since that was the original of KK on
MB. Okay, so there's a Coulomb potential, so you're heading toward the
You've got some tech in at the end.
But yes, to do that in the conflict, you have to prevent this operator protection tree apps. If you're the like accused, it's free.
So it's just either way, it's a 1% fine tune over some small range of field, right?
Well, it wouldn't be a fine tune. I mean, it would be a fine tune already. Yes, you fine tune away the mass.
Yeah.
Yes,
right.
Absolutely.
You add together all the ingredients of the compactification that contribute to eta, and you gin them to get a little region that's flat, right? So it's always going to be a little step that's flat, however you draw it. So I'm not completely sure what the question is, but yeah.
Well, I have a question about data. So let's assume that we fix the rest of particle physics. Like some people think there's going to be a light Radicino. Maybe we'll know that's true after the LHC turns on. Okay. That starts telling us that there are bounds on the reheat temperature. If we draw a reasonable cosmology. And you might guess, though again I haven't really looked at the literature, that the typical reheat temperature in large field and small field models is quite different because the typical scale of V is different. So after we know more about particle physics at the TeV scale, could we say definitively that, oh well, with the reheat temperature, below 10 to the 4 TeV, like a Radicino problem, we could not have inflated above a certain scale because the reheat temperature after such inflation would overclose the universe from Radicinos. There must be non-trivial links between these questions.
Can't you just make arbitrarily weak couplings to the standard model, put the standard model in some throat somewhere and reheat, have inflation occur by some axions or in some other throat, and the couplings are extremely
weak. Okay.
The couplings can be very weak.
You can add enough parameters that you get around the question. So what I'm asking is, if you just do the stupidest possible thing, do we get biases from particle physics that tell us you don't want to reheat above a certain temperature or you do want to reheat to a high temperature?
Well, the coupling can be quite weak. I mean, I don't know.
Sure, I think the answer is yes. The way people do it is take a typical model like NEMA has with Spitzuzzi, and then you're going to have long-lived particles, and then if too long, they're just going to reheat and destroy some part of the standard model that you wanted for nucleosynthesis or something like that. So you have to make sure that the lifetimes and everything are sufficiently short.
And the typical temperatures you get are 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 GeV, or they're much higher.
Well,
the Radicino problems are very low temperatures, but
yeah, but the whole point is that you can bootstrap something about nucleosynthesis where you believe we know what the answer is.
Sure.
And then
but that's any temperature, so I mean you have to
but this gives you a bound on where the new physics is going to be lying that fixes the problem. So it'll give you some handle on it. I'm not sure how much you can push it to, let's say, a Radicino mass, for example, etc. I don't think that you would be able to push it exactly to bound the Radicino mass precisely. But presumably, what you can do is that these things are sufficiently long-lived, they will change the Radicino state. And there will be a problem with the rest of the stuff that they should So that usually gets used to put some bounds, but I'm not sure where one can really delve into through the particle.
Well,
a lot of people who do these things, they like to have these more complicated scenarios where the temperature gets rather low and then you kind of reheat again by some late decaying particle. I mean, say to deal with this axion problem or other moduli problems.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know. For whatever reason, that seems to be the thing that people like to do. So then you can have extra time to dilute other stuff.
Yeah, okay. And then you're probably not going to get any constraints, I mean.
Right.
Well, there's also this model, this sort of irritating model building question that Andre and Renata have emphasized that, well, according to the current set of models, mechanisms that exist, there's not a nice way yet in which anybody's combined high field inflation and very low energy supersymmetry. Most of us who work on the subject, I think I can say, don't view this as likely, I mean, as particularly significant yet, but for example, if you work within KKLT, so you have some scheme like this where you uplift the potential, you find that, so in order to have gut scale inflation, you need high potential barriers, which translates into a high SUSY breaking scale because you uplifted some ADS with correspondingly large SUSY breaking. And so what Andre Nadas said as well, you can get around this with, you know, one extra wiggle in the potential, basically, and have, you know, both happen at once. But this involves a lot of fine-tuning in the combined moduli stabilization and inflationary setup. Of course, you know, this is a specific, you know, scheme for both, for compactifying moduli and for getting inflation. And so I think this is one motivation for all this technical work on trying to formulate supersymmetry preserving conditions and string theory much more broadly. So these questions of generalized fluxes and so on might have a good application to this problem.
In the Moderni case, were you already doing this? Why did the
So the first example of monodromy was a nil manifold, which broke the supersymmetry at a higher scale. The second set of examples work in any compactification with axions, but the ones we focused on were, say, KKLT like this, not KO like this, although you could do this. It's just much more fine-tuned.
So nil manifold with the right flux can preserve supersymmetry, actually.
But it can, but not the combined de Sitter construction with the inflation that we happen to use. You know, no-go theorems have a sort of sorry history in the subject, so this is not a no-go theorem. It's just a question. Is there a natural combination of those two things? Yeah.
So I'm a little confused. I mean, don't you always break supersymmetry when you have inflation?
Yeah, this has to do with the vacuum that you end up in, whether that has low energy supersymmetry at the end of inflation. Because the whole problem is related to the moduli stabilization problem, in that the inflation potential that you consider needs to not destabilize the moduli, so it needs to fit under those barriers. And the height of those barriers in some schemes like this is related to the scale of supersymmetry breaking and the ultimate vacuum you get into. So this is a simply stated open question. Is there a nicer way to combine the two than this? So other questions include, you know, as I said before, we didn't land on natural inflation or M squared, phi squared. Do they nonetheless exist in the natural wave string theory, or can we find some very broad no-go results in that direction? So people are looking at that with flux-based monodromy.
A couple of examples that don't exist in cases where we're not sure that will persist.
Yeah.
I'm not so confident about the ball field 1% fine-tuning. I mean, uh-huh. can someone... Perhaps you formulate the statement that tells us that in a small field model one can't have the symmetry. Rather, in the large field case, we needed to have the symmetry, the protective symmetry, because otherwise it was hopeless to functionally fine-tune. In the small field case, it's a matter of literature not containing an example at this point.
Well, I'm certainly not saying there couldn't be, but again, if you have a symmetry, you'd have to explain why it's valid just here and not...
A symmetry that interacts well with some hybrid mechanism to end inflation.
Well, if it's small field, you're only asking for it to protect you a little bit, right?
So the symmetry could actually work over a large field range. It's just that the last 60 eV volts are the last few bits of field space.
Yeah, okay, so this is like what Ben was asking about the new cube thought. Yeah, I mean, I certainly...
If you isn't really worrying about things in kind of polynomials for the power, isn't this kind of like your statement that a discrete symmetry eliminated a certain irrelevant operator, and so you get a different functional form to generic?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think you can draw all those tunes. I mean,
you wouldn't organize things in terms of cosines. You'd organize things in terms of powers because it's this very small field range, and you might magically eliminate 1 over r to 6 different powers.
What you need
I guess
to
it's a question.
Eliminate a bunch of dimension 6 operators, and that's it. For a small field model to be natural, Taylor expanded the right way. There's a finite list of dimension 6 operators. You have to eliminate them. That's it.
And maybe if you had eliminate 6 and 8 and 10, you get a really small
field. Yeah, but then you get a small field model that's almost large field.
Right, so maybe that's the way to organize symmetries in terms of the irrelevant.
That's operators. Clearly a finite list of operators out to any dimension in any example we know, and if you're clever enough, you know, you get Lisa the homework assignment, she'll come back in a week with some ridiculous discrete symmetry that does the job. Okay.
Yeah, that's fair. So.
You can pick your favorite phenomenon.
Well, and then Liam would insist that you find the Calabi out with that discrete symmetry, right? That's right. Well, I didn't start a fight.
Large field inflation is clearly incompatible with a cosmological concept.
I mean,
with the observed cosmological constant.
Would you care to get up and explain it?
Well, I'm waiting for Aaron to prove the theorem for me. He doesn't seem to be working on it. But if you look at Buso-Polchinski, what you need to have is lots of cycles with, you know, with the energy density of fluxes on those cycles somewhat less than Planckian. And once you have a few hundred cycles, each of which is, you know, a bit bigger than string scale, so that the energy densities are less than Planckian, you're going to have a pretty big compact manifold.
And that means the cutoff is below the gut scale, so you can't inflate above the cutoff.
Exactly.
We'll see.
What happens is a bunch of stuff is order one, and you're within the slot.
So there's a few orders of magnitude that you have to work with, and you do. I mean,
well, they don't have 10^-120 in their models yet.
Oh no! So you mean if you really try to do the CC, they have a small number of cycles. You're saying. And
yeah.
They, if they tried to do some kind of statistics, wouldn't be able to do the CC.
Exactly.
So you're saying unification couplings is incompatible with Buso-Polchinski?
Yes. Yes. Any kind of gut scale. Any kind of gut scale physics.
As David said, you have to add geometry to that too. So unification of couplings, a geometric coupling, a geometric compactification, and Buso-Polchinski.
So you can be the one to write the I hate your guts paper. If you eliminate gut scale physics in string theory.
Not the Sonosy or Sonosy Joker fight.
So I thought inflation had lots of cycles and worked for large. I guess I'm confused by the statement that.
About inflation, let me make two complaints,
yes.
Since I'm an authorized for you to complain.
Yeah.
Well, one is parametrically large and the model didn't work. So it might work numerically, but parametrically at large end, the renormalization of Newton's constant kills it. The second statement is, it does have this problem. That if you work in the geometric regime, you'll see that there are bounds on the size of a Calabi-Yau with so many Kähler classes that n is in the required number. So the volume would have to be 100, and really the lambda of inflation would be right at the scale set by the volume. So it would be highly questionably to use four-dimensional effective field theory. So, I mean, inflation is actually one place where Ben could probably, like, put nails in the coffin with this kind of argument. But their model probably works more elegantly.
But it is worth bearing in mind that we very likely live on a very, very complicated quantum computer space.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
And close to the edge of computability, too,
yeah.
Probably.
Yeah. Right, but still we can extract mechanisms. I mean, we don't need to know everything, which is why we can do something. Yeah. Well, we've been at it for an hour. I'll bet you if you want. I mean,
okay.
Yeah, I'll bet you on the tensor one. Yeah. Well, actually, I'll take all takers on that one.
What's the winning number?
From your picture, it looks like you'll give us 100-1 odds. Is that right?
Yeah. Andre's covered his bases, so no, he'd be happy with anything. Well, tensors are more just better for you know, learning more. So, but that's not the argument. Yeah, I mean the. The question is when they constrain or we'll say that they constrain with, you know, 3 sigma level at 0.01 or detect at that same level or, you know, 0.01, then we could decide the bet. Okay. Okay. Yeah. We can decide the terms. Any more comments?
So your bet is data clear. I mean, the amount of fine tuning you think, there's a crudely speaking, you might say, small field has a 1%
I actually think it, my honest opinion is we're, this is so rough, it's roughly 50-50, because roughly, you know, half the moduli are these sort of radial modes that you need to do this with. Half of them are angular modes, which naturally lend themselves to large field inflation. So my, I'm really just betting to be fun. I don't have a...
But the penalties, small field isn't 1%, 0.2, there's a lot of other things that need to be true to make it work, so that's a big underestimate.
Well, it's, yeah, this and the initial conditions. I mean, I do find the high field ones more palatable for the for
that's right. Really, that's because we have so high field ones are more palatable for the initial conditions reasons and patch reasons, perfect. But at the level of all the grounding, it's really, isn't it just that we have examples where we understand the symmetry argument protecting the potential in the large field case? The problem that could have happened without a symmetry would have been enormously worse in the large field case. In the small field case, it's never really much worse than 1%. It's just that we don't, that hasn't been a strong enough motivator for someone to come up with a symmetric model.
Yeah, it's just, this is all completely just personal taste. I just find the shift symmetries of axions more palatable than Z12 or whatever it is that you use. But this is not meant as any kind of argument, really. But is this
I'm just trying to get a feel.
Yeah. I mean, the things I like about it is just that it's natural. It is, you know, half the moduli have this angular symmetry that just, I think, sort of cries out for this. And yeah, these initial conditions things and the fact that it's, you know, the numbers are good so far and so on. But we'll see. We'll see. It's, we don't have to debate it. Okay. I know, where is Andre?